This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 17th of November, 1958. The title of this lecture is The Effect of the Environment on an Engram. This lecture is 55 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The effect of the environment on an engram. Where does an engram come from, anyway? It is a product of the environment. The person it is made by is the person who has it. But the initial look at an engram does not include who it was made by. It merely includes the fact of isness. It is. There's no use going around worrying about who made it and who didn't make it and all that sort of thing. Who cares? You start telling the public they made them themselves, and maybe they can agree with you intellectually. You can prove to them conclusively that there was nobody else around at the time the picture was taken, and that there is no kangaroo pouch for them to stow the things in. Bricklayers very often think they have kangaroo pouches that they carry just on the left-hand side of the right-hand bank, you know, and they slip these pictures in and out of. It's not true. They are made, they continue to be made by the individual. And being made by the individual, they are. But whatever the truth of that, you're not about to get any agreement on the part of the public the moment you say you are responsible for the engram. They are not going to believe you. No, the favorite public role with regard to engrams is I am the victim. I am the victim. Now, Dianetics, the modern science of mental health, doesn't breathe a word about it. In fact, at the time the book was written, there was no direct proof. There was no direct proof. And it wasn't until much time went by that a direct proof was evolved. That direct proof is quite interesting. If you improve the ability of a person to mock up, his engrams, quote, improve, unquote. You can see how an individual kills his ability to create, because his ability to create becomes so painful to him that he cannot possibly afford it. Hence, people are very allergic to the idea of creating anything. They'd much rather be parasitic. Ride along, take what the society gives them, be a government, you know, that sort of a parasite. That was not a dirty crack against government. I'm not going to malign government any further. They're good, honest, sincere men. And I can appreciate even a thief and a rogue when he's an honest and sincere thief and a rogue. And governments long time tried to plead that they were not thieves and rogues, but now have come out in the open. And so we can respect them. Now, people would much rather be parasitic. This is quite amusing, quite amusing. Contribute nothing is the motto of a person who is in very poor condition. Contribute nothing. Get it all from somewhere else. Every bit of it must be gotten from somewhere else. This is quite amusing because if you have a total parasite in a household, that person will consume everything one way or the other, either by eating it or destroying it. They will consume it. There are various methods by which they do this. They include losing things, and they also include something which you're not so alert to or aware of. It includes not acquiring. A parasitic personality will not permit others to acquire, or the household to acquire. It's quite interesting, and you've gone down into the games condition, which you know of from Scientology Fundamentals of Thought. Prevention of havingness is just a method of consuming. You got the idea? It's creating an isn'tness, you might put it that way. And the methods by which you can create an isn'tness are many. You can create an isn'tness by not having it in the first place. You get the attitude of the preclear, by the way, with regard to an engram. He tells you it isn't. That's one of his first reactions. And this, of course, means that he isn't going to have any trouble with it, of course, because it doesn't exist, naturally. Oh, rather. All of the 19th century practices went along with this, except Freudian. And Freud actually did adventure upon the fact that there were such things as psychic traumas. Only these were wounds. He conceived it as a wound of some sort or another. And, of course, a wound isn't very much. These mental image pictures that we're studying now were not totally unknown, but nobody knew their scope, size, nobody had investigated them, and nobody had anything to do with them. Because they said if they aren't, why, there's nothing being produced, and we've got an isn'tness, and that's wonderful. But now getting back to parasiticism, if an individual cannot produce without causing himself considerable pain, he, of course, will refuse to produce and will only consume. But this makes a stuck inflow. In other words, the individual inflows and inflows until there's only one direction things can go, and that is in. And we get the primary manifestation of this universe, inflow. Now, the individual who cannot and will not create, because every time he creates, it hurts. Every time he goes into creation, he re-stimulates an engram. You see, he's denying that he creates the things. But nevertheless, when he starts to create something, well, he gets an engram. Well, this individual is going to resist creativeness to the nth degree. And he's going to then consume to the nth degree, and we get the stuck flow, which is the basic mechanism of a trap. And this is how a trap is made. Scientologically, we call these things theta traps. Now, there are actual engrams of theta traps, but the whole ready universe is a theta trap. From the first moment there was any enforced creation, from that moment on, the Thetan started to get into this frame of mind that he was being made to create, and he didn't want to. And his answer was, no creation. To obtain anything or have anything then, he had to pull something into him and not take any responsibility for having made it in any way. So he went around making things and pressing them to his chest and saying he didn't make them. And therefore, he never had to take the responsibility of creating them. The second he took any responsibility for creating something, it hurt. Something hurt, and if you don't think a Thetan standing out in clean space someplace can't hurt, you're mistaken. That's a mistake that many of you have run into in the past umpteen, God help us, number of years. You say, fine, well, if I just don't get a body, then I won't hurt. It's the body that hurts, you know? Oh, yeah? What is there in a body to hurt? Hurt who? That's what you have to ask. A body doesn't hurt, not ever. A body can tangle up communication lines, but who hurts? The living being that inhabits the body hurts. And that's the only person that hurts. A fellow comes along and says, I have a toothache. And we're quite amazed once in a while when you exteriorize them, kick them a few feet back of their heads, an old Scientology practice that is not now employed, but happens all the time. First thing he cognites on is the toothache he had in his head. He now has 3 feet back of his head. And that's a very funny place to have a toothache. It's a question of who hurts. Well, he does. Teeth can't hurt. You look this over, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to disentangle this thing. Get a good look at it because you take no responsibility for your foot and your foot hurts. You say, my foot hurts. Well, that's just further irresponsibility. I've had a pretty clear sit and say, my abdomen hurts. My abdomen hurts. And I say, what hurts, you know? Well, my abdomen hurts. It's just always raising the devil with me. Now, what hurts? What's raising the devil with you? My abdomen's always raising the devil with me. That's right. And I've hinted a little bit and said, well, are you absolutely certain that it's your abdomen that hurts? Oh, yes, my abdomen that hurts. Well, could anything else hurt? And working along this line for 2 or 3 hours, just as a research project, the person finally says, you know, it's just occurred to me, my abdomen can't hurt. I hurt. Well, what do you know? Bang, and there goes the pain. And I've seen a pain hang up and not surrender to anything as long as the person was declaring that that part of their anatomy hurt and that they didn't hurt. So we come back to who hurts, and it's the living being himself who hurts. You hurt, you see. Nobody else hurts. Nothing else hurts. But you hurt. Now, the individual who picks up a body sometimes abandons one on the idea that he is tired of being hurt and the body is a source of pain to him. And being a source of pain, it then is a possession he, what, cannot have. He can't have this source of pain. So he gets out into space, and one day he's drifting down a roadway, being a happy little ghost by this time. He hasn't, he's happy in the line of being all by himself and nobody to talk to and nothing to eat, no flavors to appreciate, no girls to whistle at, and no dances to do and no governments to damn and no wars to be fought and so forth. And he's happy, very happy. And as I rather vividly recall one time, why, a dispatch rider riding a great big knuckle-headed horse came screaming up the roadway and ran square into me. Well, there it is. It hurt like hell. In other words, here was the convincer, you know. There you were. You didn't have a body. You didn't have any mass. You didn't have anything. This silly horse runs into you, and you might as well have been run over by a herd of elephants. Well, anyway, that is the big puzzler if you're not thinking about it. You say, well, I'll go out and get a robot body, you know. Robot bodies don't hurt. They don't have nerves. And after all this life, why, I've been a psychiatrist, and everybody's told me that the way you hurt, you know, neurons, synapses, that sort of thing, these things are all the source of pain. Well, if I want to get away from pain, the proper thing to do, naturally, is to go get a body that doesn't have any neurons and synapses and morons running about inside of it. And I'll just get this all squared around very nicely. He goes and picks up a robot someplace on planet X-92. Somebody hearing such a lecture and not knowing space opera and so forth and being probably quite allergic to the stuff, having been overwhelmed, let us say, a few times by electronic blast zap guns and girl officers. They're very trying. He might find himself quite allergic to this. Anyway, this psychiatrist has got himself a robot body now, you know, and he's just doing fine. And all of a sudden, why, the thought police or something like that catch up with him. He's thinking in terms of Kreplin's chart of classifications of psychoses, you know, he's re-stimulated or something of the sort. And they pick him up because he's thinking craziness about things. And he runs away and they zap him and they hit this robot body, you see, maybe in the small of the back. And it hurts like hell. and he says, "What is this? Now, a robot body can't hurt. That's not possible." He's always being startled, a Thetan is, all the way along the track, into the recognition of the fact there's only one thing that hurts, himself. He can hurt. Nothing else can hurt. And the mechanism of his pain is the postulate or sensation consequent to or necessary to experience. And this deteriorates and becomes too acute, and this is pain. He wants to live, he wants to have things happen, so forth, and just wanting any sort of sensation at all, no matter what it is, even an ice cream soda lets you on down to the dwindling spiral that winds up in pain. The individual, in other words, the individual is subject and liable to pain. He has two answers to this. One is to go above it and stay high, and the other answer is to succumb to it and go below pain and pretend he can feel nothing. And the answer of rising above it and being capable of feeling in general actually is the one that dispels pain, because pain is fear of feeling. All pain is more or less generated by just that, fear of feeling. And when he goes below pain, why, he's had it. He's had it. Because now he can have no sensation of any kind. Goes out, meets a pretty girl, kisses her, and she meets a guy, kisses him, you know, and there's nothing there, just nothing. Somebody serves him a strawberry ice cream sundae and so on. There's just no taste to it at all. They begin to wonder if life might not be different. And the main complaint about life is there's no sensation in it. That's the main thing that people complain about. They do, they're below pain, they're below apathy, actually, below emotion. And when they come up the line and start to run into things, they hurt for a while. And it tells them they better not get processed, because if they get processed, then they'll hurt for a little while. Well, of course, it's much better, isn't it, to feel nothing forever. But the penalty of getting better is to feel something. About the first things they feel are degradation, pain, apathy. Pretty grim. Now, this business of creation is very germane. In certain periods of time on the time track, in certain periods of time, the individual is at lower emotional states than others. And although he's pretty well off, let us say, for 3 or 4 years, he's liable to run into a strata where he isn't so well off for 3 or 4 years, and then something happens and maybe he gets off again, you know. Something is going on. His ability to feel, to experience, to live, and so on, is changing one way or the other. And he doesn't quite account for this. And gradually, as he gets on in years, the way they say this, it's very interesting to see a 76-trillion-year-old being complain about getting old. That's one of the sillier things that you run into. His age is just, now I'm supposed to, you know. And he mystifies himself. He doesn't know why he feels good and feels bad and he hurts and doesn't hurt. Well, the funny part of it is it might not make him well just to know why he feels bad, but he has at least entered upon the road, and he doesn't worry about it so much. Now, that, all by itself, is the mechanism behind medical diagnosis. Guy comes in, he's hurting like the devil. The doctor says, "What? That's nothing but skiatrosis myambus. That's all. And, quite so." Patient says, Oh, well, it's all right. It's got a name. Doesn't hurt so bad. Well, they've made somebody else create something about the illness. And this makes them feel that their creation of the illness is not quite so libelous and so forth. They've got it named, they got it designated, but somebody else now has charge of it. They have given it over to the doctor. And if the doctor owns it, of course, they didn't create it, and their own creativeness drops. And if their own creativeness or idea of creativeness or potential of creativeness that they're harboring at the particular moment drops, then the picture they're making drops. All you've got to do is give somebody an anesthesia and you drop his pain. Now, why do you drop his pain? It's very simple. You reduce his ability to create. Anything he makes, he doesn't have to take any responsibility for, he feels. Hypnotism is a wonderful mechanism here. All you've got to do is tell somebody he's totally irresponsible and you've hypnotized him to some degree. You say you're not responsible for it. If you prove it to him utterly, why, he is in an hypnotic trance. And if his trance is deep, he can then be monitored and moved around through phony incidents that have been fed to him one way or the other. This mechanism is a total irresponsibility, and all that has happened is the individual has been submerged below the responsibility of taking the responsibility for not creating. Or he's already not creating very much. You see, his creativeness is very low. Now, if his creativeness were high, then these engrams, which he makes up to, would get big as life and start to bite. So if he keeps his creativeness low, he doesn't get bitten. But he's at least being responsible for keeping his creativeness low, isn't he? He's saying, you know, be very careful now to be nothing but a parasite. Guys will get so anxious about this, they go around with opening up garbage cans and picking their food out of garbage cans and getting jobs as tax collectors and all sorts of things of this character. You know, they've got to reassure themselves that they aren't creating anything, that they are being a thoroughgoing parasite. Never contribute a thing. That's their motto. What they're saying by that is never make anything, never offer anything. And they at least are being careful to be irresponsible. You got the idea? Now, there's a lower level than this. There is a state whereby a person can't even be responsible for not being responsible. A person who can't even be responsible for irresponsibility. He is not responsible for irresponsibility. He is not responsible for responsibility. He is not responsible for anything. He is totally convinced of his irresponsibility. And we get then a state known as trance or hypnotism. Hypnotized. And all this is knocking his creativeness, control of, and responsibility for, down to the lowest possible rung. I used to know the mechanics of how to do this. As a matter of fact, I was taught by pretty good hypnotists, not Western hypnotists. The Western hypnotist is, he's kind of a clown. He doesn't know his business. Oh, for years, even since we've been together, I've just noticed, I tried to figure out what the devil is the lowest common denominator of hypnotism. Just what is this thing? Because it was an odd phenomenon, was banging about. I knew you could create neuroses and psychoses. I knew you could create things with hypnotic trances. I knew you could create artificial states and interesting exertions of power and so forth. And I knew that every time you did, you had something there that recoiled on the patient. Hypnotism isn't good. Nobody should ever go around beating the drum for this stuff because, one, a hypnotist in the Western society, he's not good. He doesn't know his business. And two, all he's doing is permitting the patient or subject to dramatize total irresponsibility. And three, people suffer rather heavily from being hypnotized and put into this state. As a matter of fact, it's odd, but it's one of the harder states for you to handle as an auditor. Periods of hypnotism. You can run one just like an engram. You can run one just like an engram. You shouldn't balk at one. But if you get a long series of hypnotic trances, something like that, you find that on the time track, why, run it just like an engram, and you'll find it's a very heavy lock over an engram where life just knocked this boy appetite over tin cup. It's not itself an engram, but it's a good re-stimulation of one because it's an area of total irresponsibility of creation. Now, how would you hypnotize somebody utterly? Without the mumbo-jumbo and the flicker-flack and get the fluttering eye and the pressure on the proper nerves and the great God abracadabra, you know, sort of an approach to the thing. How would you hypnotize somebody? Just straight away. Well, I can give you the answer to that now. It's a rather easy answer. You have the individual look around the environment and begin to narrow his span of attention down to a point where you run can't have on the environment. You don't let him look at the rest of the environment, therefore you denied it to him, right? Well, this has reduced his concept of creativeness, his concept of responsibility. You've narrowed his attention down to one object. You keep telling him nothing exists anywhere around but that one object. Well, you've got to have something to attract his attention, so you have a candle flame or a bright object. And it, you see, is apparently an outflowing object. The idea? It outflows light, or it outflows something. Rather. So it's telling him, too, even though his attention is fixed on the thing, that he can't have it. In other words, you just deny him everything around about the spot and focus his attention down. And some large percentage of the population simply go into a trance right there and then do anything you tell them to. I mean, it's so ridiculous that one wonders that the public hasn't objected to motor car manufacturers putting out chrome automobiles. It has nothing to do with the sales of automobiles to people who can't afford them. Of course. Bright objects. Bright objects. Objects that apparently flow back at the individual. Then put him in a trance. Unless he can take some responsibility for the object. Now, the way to defeat the action, you could go all the way through this action, all the time telling somebody he had some responsibility for the object. You get this reverse approach now. And it wouldn't work, even on a bad subject. Here's the way you'd go about this. You'd take the hypnotist's favorite tools and actions, only you'd interject this along the line as you went. Now, look at your watch, you would say. Get the idea. You'd get him to have lighted the candle flame in the first place, and you'd say, look at the candle flame you lighted now. Get the idea. And you'd say, now, of course you're aware of the whole room around you, but keep your eye on the flame. That is very good. Keep your eye on your flame there. Guy'd feel kind of potty. You know, he'd feel sort of odd about it. He'd feel sort of strange. And he'd feel like two forces were tugging one against the other. Because you're telling him, by concentrating his attention on a bright and shining object, to go into a trance of some sort or another, because his attention is off of it, his creativeness, responsibility for the environment is dropping way down, and then you're telling him it's his environment and his flame, and you've just reversed the whole proceedings. If you were to take somebody who was hypnotized a great deal by some hypnotist and work it back and forth this way, you know, and tell him, now, look at your watch, and we're right here in your room now, and look at your watch, that you wound up this morning, you know. This guy'd feel a little bit like he should, you know, kind of fade out, and then he'd sort of feel like he was brightening up. And the your watch, your flame, your room, ownership, havingness, interjections which you would make are so much the point about hypnotism that although you were uttering hypnotic patter the whole time, the individual would wind up unhypnotizable. All you'd succeed in doing is running out hypnotic trances of the past. Get this weird one then. All you'd have to do is mix up havingness, responsibility with hypnotism, and you get the exact reverse of what the hypnotist does. Now, the hypnotist says, you can't have. Here you are in Shah's temple, and the great god is looking down upon you, and here you are in his temple, and you have to be very careful to breathe right through the left nostril and smell his incense. Got the idea? Cool. After a while, the fellow's, you can't have any in the temple, and there's a bright object, and it's gleaming at him, and it's got a backflow and an inflow because it's reflecting light toward him. And he goes, wrong. All of a sudden, he says, next phrase, you are a kangaroo. And he goes, hop, 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 you know. Now, because this can be done and has been known a relatively short time in the Western world, but has been known, almost anything that is done with the mind is classified under this mystery by the people who have nothing but mystery. They say, well, there's something to do with hypnotism here. Well, in the first place, they don't even know what hypnotism is. In the second place, neither the East nor the West knew how to induce an hypnotic trance directly. What is the one thought, the one idea that induces an hypnotic trance? And the answer to that is irresponsibility. The final product of irresponsibility is hypnosis. The final button, the only button utilized by hypnotism is irresponsibility. And if you can depress a person sufficiently on the irresponsibility scale, you have an hypnotized person. If you want to create hypnotism directly, simply make a person totally irresponsible. You can explain to people that they're irresponsible. One of the ways that a plant manager could make all of his help totally obedient and totally ineffective, remember, hypnotized people are not effective, would be to take them around and show them the management's plant. You know, this is the management's machine, and this is the management's floor, and this is the management's washroom, and this is the management's this, and this is the management's that. Penalty for touching any management property is very high. Penalty for scratching any management property is very high. Penalty for is very high. Now, this machine you are going to be standing at is a management machine, and it belongs to the management and was bought at vast expense with the monies of the stockholders, and you're not a stockholder. Cool. You know, an employee would walk into that place. The next thing you know, he'd read a bulletin on the board or something like this. And it said, all employees will have tea or something in the main lounge such and such a time. And the management's giving them some tea, you know. And he'd go in, he'd sit down, and somebody could actually say to him about that time, now, we have decided never to pay you anymore. And you know, you don't have any home anymore. You don't have any children. You don't have any life of your own of any character or kind. You know, there'd be people there that believe it. They believe it utterly. You've made them totally irresponsible for the job, totally irresponsible for the plant, totally irresponsible for production, totally irresponsible for everything. And you've got an hypnotized employee who isn't any good to you nor anybody else. Anytime you want to get work out of hypnotized people, think of what you would do if you were given the inmates of a hospital or a sanitarium as your work and labor crew. People with broken legs and twisted up and sick and unable to move, requiring constant care, constant individual care. They just give you these, you see. Don't give you anybody to take care of them. They just give you these. And then they empty an insane asylum where nobody is rational. They mix the two up together, hand them to you, and say, this is the crew on which you are to proceed. Now go ahead and get your project done. People start to operate on this mechanism that those items which belong to everybody belong to nobody. And it's true. It's true. They belong to nobody. And the Russians leave tractors sitting out in the field and all winter long, you know, and they go back in the spring, and weeds have started to grow up already, and doesn't start, so they just leave it there. creating a sick country. Well, as long as managements and governments keep on doing this, they keep on depressing man's capability. And the first thing you know, they're going to have a hospital. Going to have a hospital that's 8,000 miles in diameter. Get how this would be. Now, the more irresponsible a person becomes, the heavier his bank becomes. Now, how does that work? That's because when he ceases to be totally responsible for his bank, there evidently is the feeling that something else is responsible for his bank, and that is the environment and the people in it, and they are responsible for his bank. You understand? He's making it. The environment has inflowed on him and inflowed on him and inflowed on him to a point where he says he must not reach it. He cannot be responsible for it. He cannot have it. You get that? He cannot have it. Now, when he finally gets down to this can't have it, he says, well, I hurt, therefore the environment must be hurting me. Oh, no, the environment isn't hurting him. The environment has been given full charge. An environment that isn't even thinking about it, that isn't even capable of thinking about it, has been given full charge of his mental, physical health. His good luck, his future, and everything else are now fully taken over by the environment, which is a totally unthinking thing. And he's had it. And you have Homo sap, 1958. It's all the environment doing it. Guy says to a girl, maybe she's snarling at him a little bit, and he says, now you've made my head ache. Now you've given me a headache. Not amongst Scientologists, they'd sit down and argue until they had a real good headache, and then one of them would give up and run it out, you know. But, Homo sap out here, you've talked and talked and talked until I have a terrible headache. You've given me a headache. Oh, so help me God, how far can you get into an alter isness or a not isness? Huh? The individual is making a picture obsessively, and the other person who is talking to him keys in the picture on the individual, which gives him a headache. But who must have keyed it in and put it there and put the headache up? The guy himself. But he says it was the other person. That's why the other person can do it. And that's why you, an auditor, can tell an N-gram bank to go anyplace or do almost anything, and it will. Because you don't have the preclear in an hypnotic trance and don't want him in one. Old Dianetic techniques tended to put him a bit into a trance. Wasn't necessary. He gets better the more that you move his bank around, because he's taking a look at it the whole time and he's being run on processes which return responsibility to him. But when you, particularly when you first lay your big paws on him, you could just take the bank and you can tell it to go to various dates and times and places. And he says, yes, isn't that curious, you know? Isn't that curious? He's moved my bank from the Napoleonic Wars up to World War II. And now he's moved it back in a space opera. And now he's moved it here. And now he's moved it there. You just don't understand that yet as an auditor. If you did understand it, people would be hopeless pawns in your ruddy paws. Ever occur to you? You know, you can move a bank so thoroughly that you can look at somebody and say, I have now said the thing which turns on a headache. And he'll get a headache. Pretty grim. You know, you can move him out of stuck places by just telling him he's not stuck there anymore. I'm talking about people who are not hypnotized. I'm talking about the people who will talk to you someday who are investigating the subject. They'll say, well, doesn't hypnotism have something to do with this? Doesn't it? You say, well, a headache will turn on. They'd say, how? They'd say, how did you do that? Well, you say, if hypnotism has something to do with it, then you're right this moment in trance. Doesn't have anything to do with hypnotism. Man is so occluded and so irresponsible already that you can just maul him all over the time track. And he doesn't have to have his eyelids fluttering for you to do it. Now, some guys are obsessively stuck. Some guys are one-fiving on it and are in a big ridge. But you, by talking to the bank, can still move them up, down, back, and forth in an incident, much less on the whole track. You can move a fellow in an incident without even knowing what incident he's in. Say something like, the picture will move to a later time. Just look at him fixedly and say, the picture will now move to a later time. He goes, blah, blah, blah. You say, what happened? What happened? What did you do? Always, what did you do? You couldn't move a picture to a later time unless he obeyed your moving it. See? So he moved the picture. What kind of obsessive agreement is this? But if you just had an idea of a comic book pictures, or the Louvre, or Madame Tussauds, or something like that, just hung around your PC in an invisible fashion, and you move them upstairs and downstairs, and from the early pages to the late pages, and back to the early pages again, up, down, or around, change the picture, change the scenery, change the costume. If you realize that you could do this on your normal, average person, you'd realize that to process them is really no trick. Now, you're going at it the hard way. You're telling the person to move the bank. Now, how can he move a bank or a picture he doesn't even know is there and has no control over at all and has delivered the whole control of which to you? Now, how can he move this bank? How can he go later in the incident? How can he do anything? He can't. And that's what's the matter with him. That's why he's got engrams. He can't do anything. Don't you suppose this fellow coming down seeing you with a headache would have moved to the later part of the incident where he only had a stomachache if he was tired of his headache? No, he doesn't. He comes to see you. Why? He wants to get moved. He knows who moves the bank. You do, of course. The environment moves the bank. The people in the environment move it around, but he does never. Hence you get the mechanism of restimulation, the mechanism of restimulators. You should know a little terminology right about here. The restimulator is that item in the environment which directly associates with an item in an engram on a one-for-one basis. A bureau in the environment associates itself with a bureau in the engram and will move the engram to the point where the bureau is visible. You see a bureau? The fellow puts a bureau there in the engram. But there was a bureau in the engram, or it couldn't have moved to that point. Engrams are copies of the environment, not imaginary pictures. Now, here is your greatest argument. Your greatest argument. People are going to say, well, everybody dreamed all these things up. Beautiful dreamer. That is certainly some dreaming. Man, if a guy could dream that good, he'd really be dreaming. Why would he dream that way? Furthermore, if he's such a beautiful dreamer about the whole thing, what was the idea of dreaming it up when he was 3 or 4 or 5 so that he's ever since had a twisted back? You run the engram, he doesn't any longer have a twisted back. Looks to me like that was quite a pipe dream to last from the time he was 3 or 4, huh? And if you're responsible for the engram, then why did you go back down the time track into his private life when he was 3 or 4 or 5 or whenever this thing keyed in and make him dream it up so he'd have it the rest of his life, but you didn't meet him until he was 40. So you couldn't have been back there. And we get into all sorts of these confusions, one kind or another, just they don't make sense. The individual has a picture. The picture's moved around by the environment. All right, the environment can include almost anybody or anything. And the restimulator must have been present. The conditions are these. The person must have an objection to creation. He must have an objection to himself creating to become irresponsibility for creating a copy of an incident. That he objects to the occurrence of the incident is just further irresponsibility on creation, and he gets more picture. The less responsibility he takes, the more picture he gets. You want to practically kill somebody, make him totally irresponsible. It's technique proof that goes along with this I should give to you. Look around here and find something you don't have to be responsible for. That is a wonderful process. I recommend it thoroughly for psychiatrists. They'd agree with it. They'd think that was a wonderful process. And when they'd wind up, they'd just be spun in flat. That's an irresponsibility process. That ranks right up there with, look around here and find something you don't have to communicate with. Or think of something that you don't have to communicate with. Same deal. Now, if you want the process to be totally deadly and kill somebody off only about 20 minutes, you'd run it. Think of something you don't have to be responsible for. Give him no havingness or environment or contact at all. The engram bank just beefs up most remarkably. Similarly, if you improve his ability to create, the engram bank becomes stronger. These two data correlate and coincide, and you should understand this as a scientific proof. If by creative processing you coax the individual into creating better, his engram bank mysteriously becomes better. You can check this. You can keep sending him back to a pleasure moment when he was 8 or 9 and getting him to look at this pleasure moment. And you'll find out, you bring him into PT again, you run some more creative processes, you improve his ability to create. You do little things that improve his ability to create. Then you run him back to this picture when he was 8 or 9, have him take a look at it. It's a bigger picture for this time. It isn't because you're looking at it over and over and over. It's because you're improving his ability to create. And the more you improve his ability to create, the more you improve his pictures. These pictures that he thinks he stores, he's making them right now, right then, and he makes them to the degree that he has ability to make pictures. Now, reversely, he can be made irresponsible for the picture and it'll get stronger. See this? Quite interesting. There are two parallels together. You should look it over and understand them quite well in order to get a solid grip on this idea. But the engram was a copy of the environment. It's a copy of the environment. It's a mental image picture, which is a copy of the environment. That environment has existed. Now, the best proof of it, as a little scientific drill, is to take a hammer or something and hit the person on the finger. This sounds like it's rigorous, but I'm not talking about that hard a blow. Just hit it so it hurts a bit. And then return him through the hammer blow. And make him run the hammer blow. And all of a sudden, why, he gets the pain back again, and then the pain discharges and the pain runs out. But also there's an irresponsibility there. There's an irresponsibility for that pain, and the irresponsibility is contained in the picture. Now the hooker is, he made a picture of something that he didn't do. So therefore, he thinks the whole bank is something he didn't do because it's exclusively made up of pictures of things he objected to and didn't do. So the content of the bank, its significance is, I didn't do it. They drag him down, throw him down on the beheading block and off with his head. Well, he didn't cut his own head off. So he says, I didn't do it. Maybe he didn't kill the person either that he got beheaded for killing, you know. Those make the toughest engrams. False punishment, injustice, and betrayal. If you're up the spout trying to find an engram, you can't find one, why just use those code words. Can you recall a moment when you were unjustly punished, you know, and you have the needle falling off the pin all the way on down the line? You'll find an engram. Not in just this life either. The individual then has this picture gallery of things he didn't do. And it completely escapes him that this picture gallery being a series of copies of things he didn't do, then has the significance that he didn't do it as its common denominator. But who put the pictures there and who keeps putting them there? He did. He does. Follow this? But he's putting pictures there of things he didn't do. So, of course, the individual says the environment's doing it. And he says the environment is constructing my bank for me. And the environment is victimizing me. And it's all very mysterious. Well, it's not very mysterious, I assure you. Now, he got killed in a room or shot in a room or hurt in a room or beaten in a room. People might understand this better if you just said, well, when he was a little boy, he was sick in a room. They'll buy that sort of engram. They can face that sort of thing. It's got enough nostalgia and hearts and flowers and so forth in it. And they can get stuck in the beautiful sadness of it all, and it isn't very important to the case, you know. And he was a little boy, and he was very sick in this room, and they locked him in, and then nobody would ever come to see him, and so on. There's a bureau in this room. All right. He sees a bureau quite like this in the house he's living in as he moves into the thing. And for some reason or other, he just doesn't recognize any similarity personally. Now, the less similarity he recognizes, well, it's an indicator. The more actual similarity there probably is. In other words, there is a similarity, and he recognizes it less and less, and in an engram, he doesn't recognize it at all, and the similarity is total identification, as far as he's concerned. That bureau is the bureau. So, after a while, you find him developing colds, getting little colds and so forth, because they're really an engram of measles, but they have the respiratory difficulties of colds. And then you find him lying in that bed, and lying in the bed longer and more often in that room that has this bureau in it. Now you have what's known as a restimulator. Now the associative restimulator is what he now associates with the bureau, this new bureau. Now what's associated with this? Well, his wife and his cat and his dog and his kids and this particular type of the country and all that sort of thing, they all associate themselves with this bureau. He doesn't even see this bureau. And by the way, in looking around, it is the last thing he finds in the room, if you're asking him to find things in the room. The last thing he finds is the source of the restimulation of the engram. Now, all the associative restimulators begin to develop power almost comparable to the bureau to restimulate this measles engram of when he was a little boy. Got the idea? So the environment being in charge of it all, of course, then begins to take more and more thorough charge of it, and more things in the environment, either restimulators or things associated with the restimulators, restimulate this picture and cause him to mock it up some more and mock it up harder, and at last he's totally trapped in the picture, which he makes, but says he doesn't make, and which is totally under the control of the environment. By that time, he's up the chimney and he's had it. So, when you run one of these things out, whole lifetimes tumbles out of the things. But the more you get, well, the further it goes. Now, once in a while, an auditor has difficulty getting a person into an engram. He has difficulty getting him into an engram only because of this. It isn't there, and the person has no responsibility for getting into it. So the auditor has to shove the engram onto the guy. And wherever you fail to get somebody into an engram, it's because you failed to shove the engram onto the guy. Because for his purposes, you're the environment and your authority is implicit. You've got to get him to take responsibility for it, to get him out of it, but to get him into it, you only have to take it and shove it around his face like a custard pie or something of the sort. And he has as little to say about it. Less to say about it than if you did pick up a custard pie. Now, handling an engram, which is handled all the time by the environment anyway, is very, very simple. And you, in your effort to hang the person with the responsibility for it immediately and directly before he can take it, brings on your part a failure. So you want to handle the engram, not try to get the person to handle it immediately, and you win every time. He'll wind up being able to handle this engram and handle others, but he can't do it at first. You've got to handle it for him. You're handling an engram, which something to you is usually an invisible object, and you are handling it, positioning it in time and place, and if you want to have success on it, you'll just go ahead and handle it. Takes experience, you have to have a good look at this sort of thing, and you have to know it right end to in order to have success. But I know you will have plenty of success. Thank you.